All right, hi, welcome back to LA Lit. We're here with Mark Wallace, and I think you're going to start this off with a reading from Temporary Worker Rides the Subway. Yeah?
Sure, absolutely. Temporary Worker Rides the Subway contains two long poetry sequences, and in both of them I'm using a variety of different conceptual games, process-oriented creation, and a whole series of different forms and structures that hopefully interact in certain ways that lead to a sense of kind of a pervasive game playing, linguistic game playing, in a environment dominated by economic concerns. The first long section is called Boys at the Guns and is a process text reading of a book called Barbarians at the Gate, which had to do with the leveraged buyout of RJR Nabisco, which at the time was one of the biggest instances of corporate raiding in human history, although it's since been passed along. Outclassed, excuse me. And the second one, long sequence, Temporary Worker Rides the Subway, switches from the multi-billion-dollar maneuvering of the first sequence to the maneuvering of the concept of the temporary worker, the person working for a few dollars here and there for short-term periods of time. And sort of lurking in the background of all of this second half of the text is of the idea of somebody at work who is playing certain kinds of linguistic games to destabilize the environment and make it possible to live in it in various ways, linguistic and otherwise. So I'm just going to read from the second half, Temporary Worker Rides the Subway, and there are no titles for these poems, and they run on in sort of a long sequence, but I'll just be picking a few here and there. The basic act is for any trial and sentence, rooftop, bus, we wouldn't have never been. No stop, take top, tax dollar, shirt show. A passing glance, arrested hardware. Not if or couldn't been. Bend bare, bleached banner, a certain fancy, never mind. Social critic, brand name, bonanza. Distribute if one, as if one, court of out. Calibrate emotional bloodletting, sincere fish. If ever at two, ever two, and two. The man you took to be me. Simply put, the sale was fantastic. Third show from the left, no sun from a stone, bureaucratic barn burning, don't call. We'll call care or carnage care, deepening against as pull, if any pull. Paradise, pander, love, calculate, intrepid shortchange, prospect of making you sick. Won't have grenades in my garden. Genre, simply say, simply, simply. Here's no money, sucker. Perhaps upon agenda, mean no and saying no. Reference, mistaken swordplay, institutional apartment, appears as appears. Bolster surrogate, slap house. If he didn't, recall, speaking of speech, future water dam and dam, videotape instruction, terrible termination. I loves what not in such or when. Prove it, prove it, prove it, prove it. We want workers who work for working. Working, we want workers working. Workers want working when workers want. Whistling while working without wages. Wages working for workers working while workers wait. Working keeps working. Working works while workers want wages. Whether workers want whatever, will working wait? Works of wonder will wander wildly. Wonder why workers want wonder willingly. Watch out for watching waiting workers, wanting work whenever wages wage war. Workers wanting war will work when wanted, working whether wages will wait, and whether working works for workers. We will wait, oh won't we, workers? Workers won't want this working to end. Starting a magazine? We seek work that is non-existent, counter-relational, data masturbatory, fickle, ponderous, organized by reference to obscure musical insurrections, naive about its power for change. Flamboyant, unassuming, drop the nick and tuck and screw me direct. Off your plucky little complicity, since I found you, demonstrational, ah, phooey, some crumbs there, huh? Above all, typically different product niche. He was nice until the mangling. value-laden, ossified around the random, too pernicious to merit debate. That's no way to make your way. A whore to every sloth of despond. Come in here multipurpose flame-throwing, nervous, seasonal, and ostentatious, lacking fact or fiction finally. Done again, overdone, detrimental. Packs one hell of an esoteric wallop and always repeats its own dementia. But we try to be open. Prefabrication is your greatest asset. Bruise it. Don't lose it. Candy Bear. Dead Bar. Firm, scrap-happy, malignant, duplicate fund misnomers. Ontological hunting hounds, depends mutant, re-election bake sale, stands down wind, pension, cheery weekend boat. Follow my misapplication distance, DNA hothouse, art and revolution, tagline rebate. Dan loves Marie, all the way to assistant manager. U-Haul dirty jokes, goaded party morning, fluster survival. Don't the trees look European? Titillation deepens relation, one plus one for cash. Enter big budget dragons, lovely hat. Pieces to each other, pieces. Good rebate, heightened aesthetic sense, or alcoholics in search of mood. Poker fate, climb up calamity, move for moves as moves under. Ancient calligraphic McDonald's. Dance of seven voids, can you? Naughty little think tank drama deforestation. Works as corporate tax delinquent, what a striking golden parachute. If we'd known this ledge, money is everything, poetry nothing, I believe in nothing. Straight jacket occasion, eavesdrop, central emotion, content, saying is, hopes that need critique. This next poem is called Who May Register a Complaint, and it is a found text that I have not altered in any way. A complaint may be made by any citizen, prisoner, or member of the police department. Complaints must be made in person. Anonymous complaints will be handled at the discretion of the chief. A complaint may be submitted to any member of the police department. All complaints are forwarded to the lieutenant, who is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Every complaint, regardless of its nature, is assigned for investigation whenever possible. Minor breaches of regulations are assigned to the supervisor of the accused officer's unit, since discipline is recognized as a function of command. Caution. If the investigation reveals the complaint was made maliciously or in bad faith, or with the knowledge that the accusation was false, steps shall be taken to prosecute the complainant for making a false report of a law violation whenever possible. Card-carrying members of card-carrying members, members carrying cards of card-carrying members carrying cards, remember cards. Card-carrying members carded carriers of card-carrying members. Cards are carrying members carried remembering members as card-carrying. Carry cards to be card-carrying members seen as card-carrying. Members' cards will be carried as cards for all card-carrying members. Carried cards carry weight among members carrying cards. Remember members to remember your cards. Carry those cards while carrying card-carrying members who carry cards to be seen as card-carrying. Carried cards care. Members carrying cards care for card-carrying members cured by remembering their cards. Could any card carrier care enough to find a cure, it would be you, card-carrying members, who carry cards and care about the not-so-distant future. Capitalize on your cards. Could card-carrying members capitalize on card-carrying, then those carrying cards could care for members cured by cards. Found graph number one. Workers, customers, managers. Mean, picky, neutral, friendly. new workers, comfortable workers, veterans. There's no escape from the judgments of others. Loses if one is wrong. Facts not related to you. Never came in contact with. Writing becomes choppy. Opinions are difficult. New delivery systems for old crimes. Protest pustules flustered at the dance. And now, ladies and gentlemen, for your entertainment, a final flailing after significance. They, we, shining atmospheric pyrotechnics, leaning incompatibilities. Classify all emotional variables. Adjective, noun. Consciously so. Conspiratorially so. Too permanently drunk to be further harm. Freely mountain, nowhere turnstile. In case of emergency, call. Thanks.
I have a question. Going back to Hayes and the piece that the book is titled after, you make some lucid distinction there between discourse and the challenge presented to it by hazy thinking, hazy people, sort of slippages of understanding.
Yes.
And it made me wonder, as you are also dealing in the entire book with avant-garde poetry, and sort of you have one essay, the conversion of to convert to avant-garde poetry and how that plays out and stuff. My question is, how much avant-garde poetry or experimental poetry actually deals in Hayes? In your opinion, like the actual Hayes itself?
I think that Hayes is part of all discourses, right? Although one of the things that tends to be true about the concept of discourse, at least as it's articulated not only by speech act theorists, but also by pro-Marxist critics, pro-capitalist critics, and a variety of others, is that hazy thinking confusion is kind of the problem that they are trying to get rid of. But of course, one of the things that I'm saying in this essay is that discourse and haze are profoundly interconnected in the sense that one can only define a discourse out of a ground of haze. Right? In other words, one only knows what makes sense, if you believe that it makes sense, when comparing it to a whole set of things that you believe do not make sense, and vice versa. Maybe part of the question you're asking is what happens in experimental poetry or avant-garde poetry where it works with multiple meanings and multiple potentials. And you know, depending on the kind of discourse you're in, that will be read as a kind of haze, right? I mean, there are any number of poetry critics who will simply read experimental work as all being the same, right? And that's not because it's true, but that's because when they look at that work, they see haze, right? And that's really all that they can see, right? So discourse and haze are complicatedly interrelated in my thinking, you know, by no means is my essay a call for pure discourse and against haze, right? Although I would say, lastly, that even when you start talking about multiple meanings, avant-garde literature, or whatever it might be called at this present moment, certainly has a sense of what its discourse is, right? And what counts as hazy where it's concerned, right? So I don't think there's any discourse, how alternative, that is free of this problem. And in fact, one of the things that is, you know, fascinatingly marks alternative discourses as no different from many mainstream discourses is their idea that hazy thinking is their enemy.
I wonder with the piece you just read also how in that way, you know, in the first Boys with Guns, or I can't remember the title of the first section.
Boys with the Guns is the first Boys with the Guns. Contemporary worker.
I mean, that's working with a certain discourse and then kind of like twisting it. And then a lot of the other pieces that you read here, you know, whether they be found bits or whatever, you know, it always feels like language that even when it's, you know, very collaged and cut up. It always feels like language that's addressing someone from a discourse, you know, from a particular set of, you know, kind of assumptions and all that, and knowing that the other, you know, is in on that or would recognize it as such, right?
It's impossible for me to know much of what anybody recognizes about anything that okay. I've done. Right? I mean, including myself, in the sense of you go back and read your work and you see that, yeah. the things you've forgotten so many things that were central to you at some other point in time, and then you're reminded of them again. One of the things that I've always found to be true of you know, when people talk about the issue of audience, and I like to distinguish between the concept of audience and the concept mm-hmm. of readers, right? An audience is an idea of somebody usually implies this idea of sort of passively sitting back and consuming this material, whereas the idea of being a reader is more interactive. But nonetheless, I have found that I have absolutely very little idea of who is going to decide to take my work in what way. So, you know, it's hard to know who I'm talking to, but, you know, I imagine I could be talking to lots of people or one particular person as the case may be.
I guess I was thinking less with Temporary Worker Rides the Subway, I was thinking less of like writer versus reader, and more about the kind of discourses that you're playing with, that you're using and kind of, you know, tweaking and almost like you're, you know, critiquing.
You mean discourses like the, Who May Register a Complaint, the discourse of the police department.
Yes, yeah, that kind of, the kind of discourses that you're pulling in, whether it be discourse of authority, the police department, or a sort of kind of capitalist or a corporate kind of discourse.
There's a lot of corporate discourse. Yeah. I'm sorry. There's a lot of corporate discourse in Temporary Worker, a lot of discourse about the police and other blatant, you know, control mechanisms of the culture that we live in. And there is an attempt, you know, and again, in this concept of the temporary worker in the second poem, right, is a concept of someone who is shuttled from place to place in work life in a very destabilizing way, mm-hmm. right? You know, doing different kinds of work and encountering different kinds of linguistic problems in different situations, and who responds by destabilizing the language that appears coherent, but then in fact destabilizes people,
yeah,
and makes them into a pure function of the work that they perform. Right. So what's interesting about the corporate language that, for instance, you're referencing here is that it seems on many, many levels conventionally coherent, mm-hmm. and yet its impact is one of profound destabilization.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a lot of the language in there is very recognizable. It's pretty much anyone, you know, and it's kind of, you know, we can sit back and kind of chuckle with, you know, the workers working and wondering, and then the card-carrying members, and it's, you know, through these little kind of formal things that you're doing, you're reflecting back this discourse in a weird way, and, you know, it subverting it or something like that. But what I wonder kind of formally about these, and this is something that I wanted to ask you about with Hayes as well, and something that I noticed in kind of in your work, you know, the all the work that we read, that you're kind of picking up formal, you know, tricks here and there, and like from one book to another, or within even one poem. So I wonder if you can talk about that, just like and the reason I ask that is because of an essay that I read of yours about post-avant kind of emerging writers, and how you talk about specifically, like maybe not today, but in our times, like the kind of profusion of different types of writers in the kind of post-avant world, and how you know, one could see that as a completely, writers today are completely unfocused.
Yeah.
Or we can see it as a kind of opportunity, and so if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying a lot of different things. I mean, first, back to what you're saying about the contemporary environment, I have to say that I think it's probably both, in the sense that on the one hand, there's a tremendous range of opportunity and possibility as certain kinds of more narrow discourses have been opened up. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there is, you know, in terms of the danger, right, there's the potential for a lot of work which I might call, and have called in other contexts, amorphous blob, in the sense that it's work that doesn't have a sense of its history or where it's going, right?
It's hazy.
Well, it's hazy in the sense of all of these influences are coming through, but the result is a mishmash,
a jumble,
right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that both possibilities are very much alive in our present moment, and I'm not thinking about any immediately particular writers here,
sure.
But I think that would be the condition of the moment we're in, that you know, multiple discourses and then confusion. Right, and one of the reasons I wrote the essay Haze was precisely the fact that I was dealing on a given day at that time with so many different people who were speaking so many different kinds of languages, and I don't mean just French and English and Chinese. I mean corporate, or the language of the janitors, or the language of your students, or the language of the web, or the language of interpersonal relationships, where people are very much want to feel that they understand each other, right? And yet haziness is very much part of that there. So I guess that's what I would say about the present moment. In all my books, I'm very interested in structure.
Uh-huh.
And I think that a lot of my books highlight structure and concept, right? And I think that in some ways I am a conceptual writer. But I think that I work from structure and concept towards the specifics. And for me, the specifics are not a following through of structure and concept, but a way of exploring where they might take me. I've always loved, and I'm paraphrasing here now, but Marcel Proust has the idea, the line where he's talking about how if you're really going to explore the nature of your soul, you've got to go far down into the situation, get beneath it, and get, and I think that is one of the ways that that process works in my writing. I very seldomly write a piece of writing that stands on its own without relationship to other pieces. There's a Jack Spicer kind of seriality on the one hand.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, what I'm doing there is I continue to write pieces in a given set of structures or concepts because I'm trying to uncover where it is that that's going to take me,
mm-hmm.
right? Visual artist Bruce Nauman has this line where he says, I work on a piece until I know what I'm trying to say, and then I'm done, right? Which is very interesting to me, but because I don't quite do it that way, because I will often start out with what I'm trying to say and then go from there towards all the other things that are part of it that I hadn't realized were there in the first place.
Yeah, like you said with Nothing Happened Besides I Wasn't There, you were trying to write the opposite of what you thought, and then you found out a lot from that, right?
So I do, I do think of my books as having, while they work with structure and concept, there's a sense of exploring what that is going to turn up in terms of the process, and not just a mere following through of process. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the work of Jackson McClough, right?
Yeah.
And this is not to criticize him, but he's very much a purist of structure and process. He follows it absolutely to the letter.
And doesn't change the results at all.
And doesn't
right?
change the results at all.
Here's the results,
My structures and concepts, I think of myself very much as an impurist. I'm mixing concept and structure and process with authorial intervention. And one of the things I say about the first segment in Temporary Worker is that there are three things that are at stake. There is environment, there is individual intervention, and then there is mistake. Huh. And these three things sort of form the landscape not only of the corporate world, because I think they do, but of the text that I'm trying to create here.
Huh.
I think this ties into what you say in the piece on the lyric as experimental possibility. When you talk about Ezra Pound saying make it new and how this has sort of been distilled into this meaning of, well, now we have to constantly improve on what was done before.
Yeah.
But then you say, isn't honesty and complexity of perception really what we're after? And that the newness is a reflection of the contested self living in the times in which it lives. Just everything you were talking about made me think about getting at that honesty through process and mistake and just revealing your method.
Yeah, and I would say certainly that perception and structure are interrelated, right? Because it's the structures that you're living inside that create the ground for certain kinds of perceptions to happen, right? And yet it's also your refusal or difference from or oddity in relationship to those structures that mean that perception is something very much quite unique in any number of different cases. So I guess, yeah, I mean, what I would think about, I was saying when I was writing that essay and a lot of other things that I've said, we're living in a moment now where we have long histories of experimental or avant-garde literature. I mean, we have traditions, right? I mean, and one struggles to imagine or think about those moments in human history, say when you're dealing with somebody like Walt Whitman, who's, you know, like absolutely rewriting the way poetry is looking, but he's not, you know, he's not basing it on a tradition of such things exactly, right? So all of us who are working in experimental and innovative structures, you know, I felt this way starting with people of my generation and now younger people are involved. I mean, there is a weight of history that comes down on us in a way that is interesting. And one of the things that I think, you know, inventive structure for the sake of inventive structure is not hugely interesting. I don't think many people do that. But I think the goal of an inventive structure is to reveal something about the world that could not, you know, or about language or about whatever it is, that could not be revealed through another structure. So it's certainly... I would say finally, my sense is that you know, there's structure and perception work together, and perception is really crucial to what, you know, I mean, we're trying to understand, be part of, you know, enact the world that we're living in, and structure is part of that, but it's not the whole thing.
Well, I don't know if there's any questions from the audience, if anybody's got a question for Mark. Yeah, Joseph?
Hi, am I supposed to say my name?
Sure.
Joseph. Something you were saying just a few minutes earlier about you felt that a lot of writing today was an amorphous sort of blob and lots of different influences with no... I was wondering if, is that a criticism of contemporary writing? And if so, I wonder if it betrays a nostalgia for a kind of modernist formalism that has kind of been maybe discredited or you know, the teleological idea of history.
I appreciate what you're saying. I would say that no, I don't think it is that, in the sense that... And I know this is not an implication of what you're saying, but certainly none of the post-structuralist ideas we're talking about contain the suggestion that all texts are equally well-constructed as literary objects. And so, frankly, I don't imagine that the percentage of poetry that is being... when you think about poetry and being produced in any given generation, a lot of the work that is produced is, in any given point in time, not particularly good work. And I think that we need to have critical standards regarding our poetry, even in this particular context. And so what I was meaning by, because I do think we're in a moment where there's a lot of this amorphous blob, is, but there's a lot of good work, too. Is you know, really, really work that betrays confusion more than anything else. And I don't mean by that, haziness has the good and bad sides, right? So I think that this is a danger that writers of the present moment really do need to be concerned about, not because I'm looking for a final coherence of organizing principle in a text, but because... texts are written sometimes when people don't really know what they're thinking or where they're going, and it's not going somewhere interesting.
It's funny on the amorphous blob comment. I mean, in haha, but you know, I mean, I think there's various kind of contemporary writing, you know, groups or discourses that are interested in the kind of amorphous blob of discourses and language that are out in the world and that try themselves and to create a kind of the sense of presenting the reader with this amorphous blob that's been shaped somewhat. I mean, I know we're talking. I'm using the phrase in a different way than what you're using, but also I kind of feel like in a way some of the temporary worker rides a subway. It's dealing with this kind of amorphous blob of certain discourses and languages and trying to reflect it, like we said earlier, reflect it back. And so, whether I'm talking about say FLARF poetry that is encountering a truly amorphous blob of language in the world and then, shaping it into what is still an amorphous blob, but is trying to get at a certain humor or to reflect back just the fact of, amorphous blobs of language out there. So I wonder if you can...
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right. And you are taking the term in a different way than I was saying, which is fine. Certainly, FLARF texts and many others are trying to expose us to, but I think there's a difference between trying to expose one's reader to the amorphous blob of social confusion that is contemporary America and being yourself that confusion, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the work of Casey Muhammad is just one example. It's incredibly lucid, even as the looseness is part of what he's doing. And if you read what he does closely, it repays that attention in a certain way. I think it's important. What I would be saying is, and maybe at a future point in time we'll be able to think about this, right? But just because one is doing a FLARF poem, I've done a FLARF poem, I'm freed of, some level of having to think about what I've done or having to shape it. I don't really believe that. Yeah. I'm not sure that makes me old-fashioned quite, but I understand, So you can see people very closely and carefully thinking about the shape of their FLARF text and why they want them to be that way. Or you can have, the case of a lot of concept or process-oriented work where someone relentlessly follows through on a concept that they've decided, like the Kenny Goldsmith project where you write down everything for a week, right? Now, of course, there's a lot of amorphousness in the result, but it's resulting from a concept that is, as strict and pure as I can imagine.
Sure.
Actually,
it's
a very strict purity in a certain way. So I think we've got, I think we're spinning around a lot of very interesting issues here, including my concern as to whether, and I think it's a complicated issue, as to, some process texts seem to come into their own as a performance and concept rather than as text.
Right,
which is an interesting change and has some complex differences involved, mm-hmm. right? In how one, does one read a process text in the way that one reads other texts? And I think the answer is no.
Yeah.
Right. It sets up different trajectories of what you're trying to look for.
So, any other questions in the audience? Anyone? No.
Are we out of time?
Oh, wait.
I kind of have a question, but it's not really a question.
Sure.
It's just, I mean, one of your great themes of your work seems to be economics, and
yeah, sadly,
I'm just wondering if you could talk about that. I mean, why you write about that and where that? I mean, you seem to take both a documentary approach to it, but I suspect there's also something, I mean, we all live economic lives, so.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question. I certainly do not come at this work with a completely coherent theoretical program about how to make contemporary economies function. Although there are certainly people that I like Doug Henwood, I believe his name, wrote the book Wall Street, that talks about we're never going to get away from large institutions, but we can have different ways of managing them, right? But I think, if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty of it, the fact of the matter is that one of the reasons that I'm obsessed with it is because I have wanted to be a writer, and I've been trying to be a writer for many years, and I've never had any money. And so I've been figuring out my whole life how to make a living and be a writer at the same time, which is something that, you know, I have found very, very tricky to do, and very much things at times that, you know, can be completely overwhelming of anything that I want to think about. And, you know, this, I think, plays through all my work, and you know, anybody who knows me sees, you know, a lot of the time I simply can't talk about poetry or art at all, because I'm so obsessed with, like, seeing if I can survive in some kind of functioning mode that there's nothing left to think about. And luckily I've been able to channel that struggle into writing and not just functioning.
It's tough work. Somebody's gonna do
it. Yeah, well, hopefully I'll be able to keep it up.
Well, do you want to close? I think you had...
I think I want to close with a piece from Hayes, actually.
Okay. All right.
Given the nature of tonight's discussion, this afternoon's discussion.
Cool.
This piece is called Reasons to Write. There is, of course, no reason to write poetry. If I keep writing poetry, and it isn't clear I will, it's because no reason could possibly be enough. It's because poetry exists without reasons, without memory, without forms, in a world no words themselves could describe. If I keep writing poetry, it's only because, in a world of reasons, poetry has long since stopped being possible. If I keep writing poetry, it's only because I can't be writing poetry at all. We have been sold a world of reasons so endlessly, so thoroughly, so destructively, that even poets are called upon to explain what they do, to give their reasons, to justify themselves before endless courts of indifference and terror. Yet poetry does not have, and never will have, a justification. Poetry reveals that justification itself is nothing more than poetry that has failed, become degraded, fallen into a world of reasons that will always miss the value of poetry, which no more needs a reason to exist than a person needs a reason for being alive. We live now in an empire which, in the name of reasons, has stolen our lives away from us, but which will sell them back to us at the cost of all that we have, if only we can provide that empire with sufficient reason for letting us live. Every time we speak of a reason, we let the theft occur all over again. We participate in the theft. If we lived in a world where poetry existed, who knows what it might be? It's a question I ask myself when I'm writing the poetry I can't be writing. What fields of possibility might our senses open onto? What lurid and glorious chambers might ransack our minds? What intellectual, physical, and spiritual engagement might our bodies make in contact with the bodies of others if only we lived in a world where poetry was permitted? It's a question that can't be answered, and so can't even be called idealistic, because as long as we live in a world of reasons, nothing but reasons can possibly be real. And what was ever less real than a reason? If I keep writing poetry, it's out of desire so unproductive, so unnecessary, so unspeakable, that if anybody could be made to hear them, the world of reasons would instantly be demolished, would cease to exist, just as everything I think I am and everything others think they are would cease to exist. If I keep writing, it's only because I know this demolition can never happen. If I keep writing, it's only because this demolition happens all the time. But no one, especially myself, can feel it. No one can even imagine it. I write poetry because I need to make a living.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark. That was great. Thank you.